Okay. Good morning. We're going to be continuing our discussion of complex brain functions this morning with a discussion of sex differences in the human brain and behavior. Some of you might be thinking, oh, how passé, women and men are the same. What's the big deal? Why talk about sex differences? Hopefully by the end of this lecture, you'll be able to think meaningfully about sex differences in the human brain and behavior. It is a big deal. NIH now requires all, or NIH is the U.S. National Institute of Health, requires all new funding applications to have some consideration of sex differences in whatever disease under study, that it's not enough to say, well, no differences have ever been found, that in order to apply for funding, you have to have considered the role of sex and sex differences on whatever behavioral trait or clinical disease you're studying. So hopefully by the end of this lecture, you'll be able to think critically about sex differences in the human brain and behavior. But let's just start by probing how many of you believe there are sex differences in the human brain specifically. How many of you would agree with this statement, true or false? Sex differences are present in the human brain. Okay, I see some of you coming in. Have a chance to grab your clickers. So we get a chance to survey you as well. How many of you believe sex differences are present in the human brain? Okay. Give a few more people some time to come in, click in, so we get a chance to hear your opinion as well. Are sex differences present in the human brain, true or false? Okay, let's see what you think. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 91% of you say, yes, I agree. How many of you would agree with the next statement? Sex differences in brain function and morphology are consistent across individuals and pervasive across the whole brain. It's a very different statement, much more specific. Are sex differences in brain function and morphology consistent across individuals, human individuals, and pervasive across the human brain? This question will make a lot more sense, will be much more meaningful to you at the end of the lecture. But let's see, I'm going to give 10 more seconds for you to weigh in. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Great. So this is true. Sex differences are present in the human brain and in human behavior. But they are nowhere near as pervasive and consistent as we see in animals. And again, I want you to be able, by the end of the lecture, to think critically about this statement, be able to discuss the types of brain functions. What functions do we find sex differences in? Which brain structures do we find sexual dimorphisms, which we'll define? And do we see that consistent across humans? So what do we mean by sex? It's a biological variable. It's a genetic variable. It's encoded in the DNA. There are two kinds. So in this case, it's a matter of category. A matter of kind. It's either male or female. It's either XX or XY. That's a very different variable than gender, which is more of a matter of degree. So when we think about gender, we include social, cultural, psychological traits that are linked to more feminine or more masculine characteristics, and that we include some environmental, social influence. So it's not just about the DNA, XXXY, there's a range of things that are taken into account. And when we think about feminine and masculine characteristics, it's more of a curve with a lot of overlap. So a sexual dimorphism is an endpoint. Now, when we say endpoint, that can mean a behavior, structural morphology, and in a dimorphism, the endpoint consists of two forms. And so on a curve, it looks like this, completely bimodal, so that all females behave in one way, all males behave in another way. Perfect dimorphism has no overlap. There are two nodes, or it's a bimodal distribution. So in animals, you see this frequently. In animal copulatory behavior, guinea pigs, rats, the males will have mounting behavior. The females will have lordosis, which is the arching of the back, kind of a receiving posture. And there's very little overlap. The males show one behavior, the females show another. In bird song, you find this. So males have one song. Females of a certain species either don't sing or have their own specific song, again, with very little overlap. But when it comes to humans, what we more often see are sex differences. And sex differences can be thought of, again, as two curves, masculine, feminine, which tend to have a lot of overlap. So the endpoint exists on a continuum, and the average is different between males and females. But there's considerable overlap. Even if there are statistically significant differences, there's still overlap. So we'll come back to a chart like this frequently when we talk about human behaviors and sex differences in human behaviors, because it's often distributed in basically it looks something like this, where you have a sex differences between two averages, but with a lot of overlap in the distribution. So some of the things that we'll talk about will be cognitive differences. We might see sex differences in pain thresholds. By the way, men have higher pain thresholds. I was surprised by that finding because I thought women having gone through childbirth would have higher pain thresholds, but it turns out evolutionary-wise, men have higher pain thresholds. But things like fear and anxiety, learning and memory, we do see some sex differences, very small, but present, and we'll talk about those. And then there's this other term, which you don't really have to know so well, but it exists, which is sex convergence. That's when the endpoint is the same between males and females, but the underlying hormonal or chemical milieu is different. So the hormonal milieu might be different supporting that behavior, but the behavior is the same. And so the best example of that is caregiving behaviors, that women might have different hormones driving caregiving behaviors, but if someone dropped down from Mars on a playgroup in Brooklyn on a Saturday afternoon, they would see men behaving in very similar caregiving ways as women. So the endpoint is the same, but the hormonal milieu is different. So we don't talk about that term a lot in this lecture, but we will use the term dimorphism and sex differences frequently. Now, in the literature, you'll often see sexual dimorphisms referred to humans, but just keep in mind that in actuality, dimorphism is two nodes and they don't overlap. So they're probably talking about a sex difference, which is when there's lots of overlap. So where this really becomes relevant for clinicians is in the sexual biases in the manifestation of different clinical disorders. So we see male-female ratios that are very different for different disorders. So some of the male bias conditions would be ADHD, where there's for every one female, 10 males with ADHD. For autism spectrum disorder, it's a 4-to-1 male-female ratio for every one female, 4 males with autism spectrum disorder. Dyslexia, it's about 3.5-to-1, and Tourette's syndrome about 3-to-1. So these are pretty consistent, well-replicated sex ratios in clinical disorders. In females, we see a whopping difference between the manifestation or the prevalence of anorexia, which is much higher in females, a 13-to-1 female-to-male ratio. Autoimmune disorders have a 3-to-1 ratio, female-to-male ratio. Depression, 2-to-1, female-to-male. And anxiety, for every 2 females, 1 male with anxiety. So what you notice is sort of a trend here with males having higher rates of disorders with neurodevelopmental origins, ADHD, autism, so with origins in early development, and females having higher prevalence of adult onset disorders. And there's some thinking around that. There's some work being done in looking at whether having an extra X chromosome might be a protective factor for females in terms of neurodevelopmental disorders. I mean, certainly for X-linked disorders, but for something like a genetic mutation on the X chromosome. So a lot of the high-risk autism genes have been found, or the we call them copy number variant mutations. So some sort of deletion or duplication of a chromosomal region on the X chromosome might lead to a higher risk of autism. And that females have an extra X chromosome. So if there is a mutation, there's another chromosome that could make up for it, whereas males don't have that. So there's some thinking that females can carry a higher mutational burden because they have that extra X chromosome. So it might be a protective factor against some of the disorders with neurodevelopmental onset. So that brings up the obvious statement that for every neuron, glial, cell type carries either the male complement, the XY, or the female chromosome. You would think that that would then be the major contributor to sex differences in brain and behavior, but actually what's been most studied and what has the most robust effects are hormonal differences. So we know that the genetic XY versus XX determines the gonads, and we'll get more into that. And the gonads determine the hormones that are released, and the hormones actually have the biggest influence on differentiation of the human body and brain. So the masculinization of the human body or brain, that depends on hormones, and we'll talk more about that. But that can be differentiated in mice with recent experiments that actually manufacture, so the typical male would have the SRY gene on the Y chromosome, the sex-determining region of the Y chromosome, and would have testes. But you can manufacture mice to essentially have females, XX, with the SRY gene that then develop testes and so have testosterone. So an XX female with testosterone, so therefore masculinization of the phenotype. So there, this can be pulled apart. But what we'll largely be talking about in this lecture are effects that have been learned from the hormonal influences, testosterone and masculinization of the phenotype due to early hormonal influences, not so much the actual genetic, the direct genetic influence on human brain and behavior, because we don't know as much yet. So let's go through that classic model of sexual differentiation based on hormones, meaning, yes, the XX or XY determines whether we have ovaries or testes, but once the gonads have developed, then you have the release of testosterone in males, which leads to the masculinization of the phenotype, or what we also call the defeminization. So why is it called defeminization? Because feminization is the default, right? In the absence of testosterone, there will be a default feminization of the phenotype. In the presence of testosterone, you have masculinization, and we'll get more into the specifics of what that means, but at this point in the lecture, I want you to understand that those early hormonal effects have what's called organizational. So there's a critical period in early development where the effects of testosterone, the hormonal effects, will determine the cell's fate, meaning in the early organization critical period, which is about 12 to 20 weeks of gestation, the presence of testosterone will actually determine the fate of certain cells, their morphology. And that's what's called a sex-specific or restricted fate in the sense of developmental neurobiology, that cells will adopt a restricted fate. And that can't be reversed during the organizational period. But during the activation period, which is essentially later on past the critical window, you can have effects of hormones that can be reversed. So you have early organizational effects during a critical period, and you have later activational effects of hormones on the human brain and behavior, which actually can be reversed. So what are some of these differences, sex differences? We can start with the most obvious, which is that females and males have a different hormonal milieu, that once the gonads have developed and females are developing normally, we have more of a cyclic release of hormones. So from the hypothalamus, the gonadotropin-releasing hormone will stimulate, this takes you back to some of your endocrine and reproduction, but just as a review, will stimulate the anterior pituitary to release luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone, which is happening in males and females. And they do have effects in males and females. But in females, it's cyclical, meaning we have higher GnRH certain times of the month during ovulation, which leads to more LH and FSH. So the big point here is that, yes, the same hormones are released, but at the level of the gonads, essentially, the triggering is in males of more testosterone, in females of progestin and estradiol, and that it's cyclical in females, whereas this is acyclic, generally acyclic in males. So that's a big difference that's more obvious. When it comes to human behavior, it gets a little less obvious. So there's a group in Israel that took about 1,400 people and surveyed just as stereotypic sex behaviors as you could imagine. So things like boxing, construction, playing golf. So they did a range of behaviors just to see if we pick the most stereotypic male or female behaviors, do we see big differences in between males and females on those behaviors? So here you can see for some of those stereotypical behaviors, the Cohen's effect, the effect size is quite big. So just to remind you, a Cohen's D of 1 is a very large effect size. If you have a Cohen's D of 2 or 5, it's a little more small to moderate. Typically, you want to have one about 0.8, but 1 is a large effect size. And with a Cohen's D of 1, there's still 44% overlap. So most of the stereotypic behaviors, boxing construction, that have about an effect size of 1, have 44% overlap. And even the most stereotypic, wearing cosmetics, so that had the largest effect size, still has 29% overlap. So for whatever human behavior you can think of, and the most stereotypic in terms of female versus male, there is still a lot of overlap. The point there are a lot of guys out there wearing makeup, right? That this happens. There are actually online tutorials, and it's starting to become more of a thing. But the point is, in animals, this might be pretty dimorphic, but in humans, there's a lot of overlap, that human males and females have a lot of range of behaviors. So now we're going to start looking at some of the literature and sex differences in human cognition. Very controversial. So we'll do a little in-house experiment. Everyone click in. I want to see our sample size. Okay, so we have a sample size of, great, nice representation across females, males, and others. Now I want to give you one of the classic cognitive tasks that shows the largest sex differences in cognition. Okay, it's a 3D visual rotation task. So which one of these is the same as this one, just rotated? You have 8 seconds left. 6, 5. Okay, so the outcome of that experiment is essentially females are quicker. Let's go back and do it again. Let me reset. I'm determined to get valid data here. Let's start it up again. going to reset these two. No, I didn't take it off. It just died. Okay. Let's try this again. Now you're ready. When we get to 351, I know everyone's clicked back in. This isn't such a hard question, right? You just answered it. Go ahead and click it. Okay. Gonna move on? Try this one again. So if you're female, respond to A, B, or C. If you're male, D, E, or F. And if you're other, G, H, I. Okay. So interesting that we have a little bit more females choosing the correct answer, because that's the opposite of what you find in the literature. In the literature, males typically have an advantage on this type of visual rotation task. It is one of the only robustly replicated cognitive effects that show a consistent sex bias. Males seem to do better with visual rotation, but the effect is only about 0.5 to 1 standard deviation, so not necessarily a huge effect, but seems to be consistent across cultures. Females tend to have more of an advantage of a comparable magnitude, about 0.5 standard deviation difference between females and males, in language, reading, and verbal fluency. Across 75 different countries, they show a female advantage in reading achievement. So these are subtle effects. They're not strong. They're not seen across all individuals, but they are replicated across cultures. And they suggest maybe there is some from hunter-gatherer origin, some male bias or advantage for visual rotation processing, and females for language. But again, not of a big magnitude and lots of overlap. So then the question is, how much is that driven by hormonal levels? So there have been some experiments to show, well, females have higher testosterone. Do they do better on visual rotation tasks? Is this a hormonal-driven effect? Is this an activational effect or an organizational effect? So what do I mean by that? If you give someone testosterone, are they going to do better on visual rotation tasks? Or was there some early effect of testosterone on the development of the brain, which then manifests throughout life as an advantage? That's the difference between an early organizational effect and a later activational effect, right? When you give a hormone, you might see some male-specific behavior. So what they found is virtually no effect on the levels of testosterone, salivary testosterone, in females. Sorry, let me get my laser pointer. So this is a scatter plot that shows salivary testosterone and the response on a visual rotation task, no effect. So when the dots are all basically even distributed across a scatter plot like this with no clear linear distribution, you would see essentially a line like that, a flat no effect line. So there doesn't seem to be an impact of testosterone, salivary testosterone, on visual rotation in males or females or males. So there is no relationship in either. So what does that suggest? That visual rotation advantage in males is based off of organizational or activational effects. Exactly. That maybe some early testosterone impact the development of the brain. So now, what do we mean by that? Impacted the development of which structures in the brain? Where do we find actual differences in brain morphology between males and females? One of the most obvious ones is in total brain volume. But that's not so interesting, because men are just bigger, taller, right? So bigger brains does not necessarily equate to better cognition or better function. So it's just something we have to control for. Whenever you look at sex differences in brain volume of even specific structures, you have to control for total brain volume. So all of the research we look at controls for total brain volume when considering male-female differences. So where do we find them? In rats, it's pretty clear. there's a big famous region called the sexually dimorphic nucleus. It's no mystery, it's in the name, right? It's the one area that is consistently bigger in males across not just rats, different species. And it's bigger in males. It's in the preoptic region of the anterior hypothalamus. So you'll see this SDN referred to as the SDN of the MPOA, the medial preoptic area of the anterior hypothalamus. And just to remember that it is larger in males, up to 4 times in rodents. And in humans, that area, the human homolog to the sexually dimorphic nucleus, is called the interstitial nuclei of the anterior hypothalamus. So if you see any of those three terms, SDN, interstitial nuclei of the anterior hypothalamus, or MPOA, which is the medial preoptic area of the anterior hypothalamus, they're all referring to a well-replicated finding of larger SDN in males than females. So in animals, it's a lot bigger effect than in humans, but in humans, there are 4 nuclei, 1, 2, 3, 4, the INAH, 1, INAH, 2, and so on. And the biggest difference seems to be in the INAH3, where it's 2 times bigger in males than females. And that's replicated, and it's been found for volume, for the number of neurons in that nuclei, and the size of the neurons. So across different studies, it's a replicated finding, and INAH3 seems to be the most dimorphic in humans. So originally, the human homolog to SDN was believed to be 1, but now it's thought that that's probably INAH3. Because it shows that same dimorphism larger in males than females. There's also another area that has been examined, the suprachiasmatic nucleus. We know that from our biological rhythms, that another region of the hypothalamus that is involved in circadian rhythms. It is larger in males than females in rodents. And in humans, it seems to be shape difference. In males, it's a little more spherical, and females more elongated. So not as much of a volume difference, but a shape difference in the SCN. So there are a lot of areas, right, that have been found to have this same type of dimorphism, all in the hypothalamus, the INAH, paraventricular nucleus, the ventromedial nucleus, all with larger volume or neuronal number in men compared to women. One more area that's been studied is the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, which is essentially a few different nuclei, a little bit outside of the hypothalamus, near it, but it's that important region connecting the amygdala to the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that we talked about in the stress lecture. So the BNST has also been well-researched in terms of showing a consistent dimorphism with males being larger. So that, what's the take-home message here? In the hypothalamus, in general, males show a lot more, where there's more dimorphisms, and they seem to be larger in males than females. So a lot of different nuclei of the hypothalamus, which is no surprise because that's the main area controlling hormonal release. So we see more dimorphisms there. The problem is this is all from histology. So there's a lot of issues with histology when you try to compare across samples, smaller sample size, sometimes the fixation techniques, the quantitative techniques for counting cells, for measuring cells, and the age differences in the subjects. So another way of approaching this has been through MRI. And what we find in MRI is that, in general, you can't look at the specific nuclei of the hypothalamus, but you can look on the whole. Is the hypothalamus larger in males after controlling for total brain volume? And yes, it does seem to be the case. Not in all studies, but in some of the big studies, the hypothalamus is bigger than in males. It's not always replicated. But you also see female, after controlling for total brain volume, there are some regions that are higher in females. So in this figure, it shows all the areas in pink are larger in females. So a lot of the mesial prefrontal regions, and the, here we go, lateral prefrontal regions, whereas in males, the angular gyrus and the subgenial cortex was larger. And these are all regions that have high density or high levels of sex steroid receptors. So in general, it's not just males bigger than females across most brain structures. There are a lot of regions where females have larger structure than males. This one study that, again, when I showed you the sex-specific or the stereotypic behavior, scrapbooking, watching porn, right, these things seem to be more stereotypic males like one versus the other. I can't remember which that was. Maybe you can. So in this same study that they looked at the stereotype behaviors, they also looked at the MRI scans of 1,400, so as a meta-analysis. And what they found was that there were some regions that consistently showed sex differences. So females had bigger caudate, left and right. Females had larger left and right hippocampus, had a larger left inferior frontal, larger right orbital frontal, and larger left and right gyrus rectus. So these were some of the consistently replicated findings. But what I want, because you don't have to memorize all these, I want to make a main point here. And the point is, these different dimorphic or sex difference findings between males and females were not consistent within any of the, well, only 6% of the individuals showed all of them. Okay, so what I mean by that, this is one finding. This is another finding. How many of the females showed larger structures across all of these findings? Only 6% of the sample. So the point I'm trying to make is that this sex difference was not seen across all the structures in all the females. Or for the male bias structures, the same structures weren't seen. Only 6% showed the super sexy brain, which had a consistent sex difference in all the structures where that was found. The main point is that these sex differences, even in brain morphology, are not consistent, and they're not found across all structures. So there's no such thing as a female brain or a male brain. There might be some structures that are more female in terms of in the dimorphism. If they're larger, that might be more female. But none of the structures consistently showed that pattern. So the main point there is there's lots of human diversity, unlike animals. So now we start getting into some of the two biggest sexual or the dimorphisms in humans in terms of behavior. So most males identify as male, and most females identify as female. But transgender, about 2 to 6% of males will have an identity. I'm sorry, that's for sexual orientation. I don't know exactly the percentage for gender identity, but a certain percentage for gender identity will be opposite the chromosomal sex, the gonadal sex. So that, in a sense, some people have a gender identity that's not consistent with their chromosomal sex or even their gonadal sex. And that exists in humans. And also, we can have sexual orientation, which is more an enduring pattern of romantic interest, that is not consistent with our chromosomal sex. So that's where the percentages come in. About 2 to 6% of men will have a sexual orientation towards men. But the majority will have a sexual orientation towards females, towards women. And for women, it's a little less, but still about 2 to 4% will have a sexual orientation towards other women. So this happens in humans where we have what we call a sexually dimorphic behavior, like gender identity or sexual orientation, is not consistent across the board. So then some researchers have asked the question, can this be linked to some of these sexual dimorphic structures that we see in the brain? So we know that INH3 is larger in males than in females. And what some researchers have looked at is whether the INH3 play a role in sexual orientation. And some studies have shown that, yes, it is a marker for sexual orientation in that it's smaller in men who have homosexual orientation compared to heterosexual orientation. So that means it's essentially closer to the size found in women. So if this is a marker for sexual orientation, essentially a smaller INAH would reflect the sexual orientation that's inconsistent with the chromosomal sex. Another area is the bed nucleus of the striatum renalis that's bigger in males than females. In both the INAH3 and the BNST, there seems to be a marker for gender identity, and that it's smaller in people who identify as transgender, but transition from male to female, than in males. So we know it's larger in males that identify as males than in males that identify as females. The size of the INAH and the BNST is closer to females. So the point there is that there are sexually dimorphic structures in the brain that may play an important role in behaviors such as gender identity and sexual orientation, and that show a size that's closer to the, in this case with males, to the females in terms of gender identity and the sexual orientation of females. So now we're looking a little bit more into those early organizational effects and masculinization and feminization of the phenotype. But where, just as a review, which chromosome determines gonadal sex? Okay. Yep. 75% of you recall that chromosome 23 contains the either XX, XY, and sex-determining region of the Y chromosome. And so going back to the SRY and the relevance, so when the SRY is present on the Y chromosome, we develop testes. When it's not present, humans developed ovaries. It's as simple as that. What if you put SRI, if you translocate it onto an XX chromosome? What would happen? Exactly. It's as simple as that. If XRY is there, humans develop testes. So essentially, SRY leads to development of testes, which leads to the release of testosterone, and testosterone masculinizes the phenotype, the body and brain phenotype. So now we know what that means. When I say masculinize the phenotype, meaning larger INAH, larger SCN, these hypothalamic structures, of course, and all the obvious things. I'm just not talking about the body because we're in a neuroscience lecture, so I'm focusing on the brain. But you know all the obvious masculinizations of the physical phenotype. Now, what happens in the absence of SRY? Essentially, this is the default, that there's masculinization or defeminization, but feminization is the default. In the absence of testosterone, we develop a female phenotype. So here's an interesting little piece of the puzzle, is that testosterone goes through a process of aromatization. So the enzyme aromatase breaks it down, testosterone, down into estradiol. So essentially testosterone, by the time it's been broken down into estradiol, acts on the receptor as if it's estradiol. So essentially, if you give a female, or if you give a baby estrogen, a female estrogen, it will act like testosterone, because in the end, the product is the same. It's going to act on the estradiol receptors the same. So what does that lead to? Transcription factors and actual morphological changes in a cell. So this is what we're talking about in the early organizational period. You have transcription factors that lead to the cell restricted fate. And again, the point here is that whether it's estrogen administered or testosterone, it's going to act the same way in that early organizational period. So what does that mean for this scenario? What happens if an XX female is exposed to high estrogen during those critical periods of 12 to 20 weeks? Okay, so let's find out. So, yeah, it's a tough question. And the two biggest answers here were, okay, their gonadal sex will be female. We've all established that. Their XX, so their gonads will be ovaries. But what about their, will they be masculinized or will their phenotype be feminine? So estrogen is going to essentially act the same way as testosterone in that early organizational period, because testosterone is converted to estradiol and acts on the cells in the same way as estrogen would. So paradoxically, if you give estrogen, and we'll talk about cases in the literature where this happened, where estrogen was given synthetic estrogen, then it will masculinize the phenotype. It will act similar to testosterone. And we'll come back to this because it's a bit confusing, but early on, if females are given high levels of estrogen, then it will act similar to testosterone and masculinize the phenotype. Now, we're not talking about developing testes because it's too late for that. The critical period is 8 weeks for development of the gonads. Here we're talking about masculinization of the phenotype, which happens in this critical period of 12 to 20 weeks. So what happens in a disorder where you have an insensitivity of the receptor to testosterone? So let's say you have SRY, you develop testes, everything's normal, levels of testosterone are normal, but there's no receptivity to the testosterone. The cells are receptive. Will the phenotype be masculine or feminine? Exactly. It will be a female phenotype because there's no receptivity. So the testosterone can't act on the cell in the way it needs to masculinize the phenotype. So that's called androgen insensitivity syndrome. It's caused by a mutation in the gene that produces the androgen receptors. So when the children are born, they're XY males, but what are they mistaken for? Females, because they have not, their testes have not descended, because you need testosterone, right? Taking back to the endocrine reproduction, you need testosterone for the descension of the testes, the full development of the externalized externalization of in males. You need testosterone for that. So with the Wolfian and the Mullerian ducts, the testes will release Mullerian inhibiting factor, but not the testosterone, but there will be essentially an insensitivity to it. So on the outside, females will look, or the males, XY, will look female, and they'll be raised as female. But the problem is they get to adolescence and they're infertile. Why? They don't have ovaries. Exactly, that simple. And so it's not always all cut or dry. Sometimes there's some partial insensitivity and there might be some ambiguous genitalia. But in general, a complete androgen insensitivity disorder would lead to what looks like a female. Essentially, she doesn't have ovaries. So she's often raised as a female. Now, what about the masculinization of the phenotype? Does that occur in the absence of testosterone receptivity? No. So what do we think her SDN would look like? Female or male? Female, because the SDN is part of that masculinization of, or so in the absence of testosterone receptivity, the cells of the SDN or any sexually dimorphic nuclei in the brain would essentially be more feminine. So, and it's, well, we'll come back to this in another case where you have when you give a child estrogen. But for the moment, I just want to go back and review the critical periods. So we have at 8 weeks the development of the gonads. At 12 to 20 weeks, we have that masculinization of the brain phenotype, which would refer to all of those nuclei we just talked about, and also the body. And then we have another critical period in adolescence, right, in puberty. But the organizational effects are not as strong. So there are strong organizational effects early on at 12 to 20 weeks. In puberty, they're not as strong. They're considered a little more reversible. So where that matters in terms of gender identity, if there's gender identity that's not matching the chromosomal identity, then there are actions that can be taken critical before the second critical period to essentially have the gender identity be more consistent with the biological, in this case, the gender identity be more consistent with their actual physical phenotype by giving hormones prior to that critical period. And you'll think about that a little bit more with Dr. Kirkby in the gender identity disorder lecture, which comes next. So another case where what we were talking about, if children are given, or so if mothers are given synthetic estrogen during their pregnancy, right? So this happened in the 70s. There was this idea that D-ethylstilbestrol could prevent miscarriage. And so women who were at higher risk for miscarriage were given DES. And what they found is that given synthetic estrogen actually tended to masculinize the phenotype. So this comes back to the idea that the estrogen was converted essentially to estradiol, just like testosterone, and acted in that early organizational period on the cells just like testosterone would. And so they had higher rates of homosexuality. Now, when I say higher rates, it was like 25%, right, which compared to 2 to 4% is higher. But it's also good to keep in mind that 75% of the sample was rated heterosexual. So it's not so simple. It's not simply a matter of hormones acting on the cells in a consistent manner that you see such a range of diversity. And none of these effects are across the board in humans. So clearly, it's not just hormones. And that's why there's a lot more interest now in the actual genetic effects, not just the hormonal effects, and why they've manufactured mice to be able to look at the genetic effects as well as hormonal effects throughout the lifespan. In DES exposure in rats, the SDN was larger. So what does that mean if the SDN is larger? Is that the masculine or feminine phenotype? Masculine, good. So SDN larger is a masculine phenotype. So when they gave females DES, rats, it tend to masculinize their brain phenotype, the SDN. So that led to the train of thought that maybe the SDN was playing a role in sexual orientation, and essentially by masculinizing the SDN, it was leading to sexual orientation towards, in this case, females, because that would be the masculine dimorphic behavior. So just as an overview, it's really complicated in humans. We do have, you know, XX and XY, which is pretty straightforward. But after that, there's a range of different social, cultural, biologic, hormonal effects, whether it's from, you know, teratogens like DES, or even being in the womb, some babies being a twin, like a female being in the womb with a male twin, has shown to have higher exposure to testosterone, which some people have argued masculinizes the phenotype of females. So there's a range of influences that can end up masculinizing or feminizing the phenotype in humans, which is why it's not so simple to talk about dimorphisms when actually where you end up talking more about sex differences and studying sex differences. Okay, so thank you for your attention, and now you get to hear about the disorders with Dr. Kirkby.